Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to Huff Takes. This is our very first episode. We're so happy to have you with us. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
I'm Haley Birdwell.
And we're going to start things off in this episode with a conversation about our favorite story arc of Star Wars, The Clone Wars. I'm guessing most of our listeners have watched The Clone Wars. I certainly hope so, because it's a fantastic show. I would highly recommend it. But if not, maybe skip this episode, frankly, because we're about to discuss some of the most important story arcs and, frankly, some of the last few story arcs. So if you're just joining us because you know us personally and you want to see what our podcast is like, but you're also sort of a Star Wars fan and you might want to watch The Clone Wars, turn this episode off right now. In fact, just press pause. Don't even let me finish this sentence. Just stop listening to this episode because we're going to get into spoilers. We're going to just have kind of a freeform conversation here about these arcs and what they mean to us. I am going to be talking about, I think it's actually the last story arc of season 5, which focuses on Ahsoka Tano framed for murder and eventually, again, spoiler alert here, leaving the Jedi Order. Grace, which arc did you pick?
I am going to be talking about the Mortis arc, which happens midway through season 3. And that's when Anakin, Ahsoka, and Obi-Wan go to this weird planet with Force gods who teach them about the Force.
And Haley?
Yeah, so my favorite arc in The Clone Wars is it happens at the beginning of season 6. It's when Fives sort of discovers the plot for Order 66. And it's very frustrating, but I just think it's great. I really enjoyed it. I watched The Clone Wars as a kid when it came out, but I never saw this arc, because I was watching on a weekly basis, and sometimes you would miss episodes, you know, back when TV wasn't something you could, you know, binge or stream online. But I watched this one this past year, and it, like, I don't know, I thought I just told the story of the clones, like, very well in this one, like, you know, quest to figure out what was going on, and it filled some gaps for me and made me appreciate the prequels a lot more.
All right, so I realized that we never decided before we started recording who is going to go first. So rather than just like randomly pick one of the three of us, let's do it this way. Let's each say a number between 1 and 5 at the same time, and whoever's number is highest goes first. Does that sound good?
Sure.
I feel like it's an appropriate gimmick for this show to start us off and give our listeners a sense of just how ridiculous and zany this show can be. I'm going to count to 3. 1, 2, 3, 4.
7. Wait,
I forgot. Wait, it was 1 and 5?
Sorry, yeah. Sorry.
It was definitely supposed to be 1 and 5. That's fine. 7,
I know, I just
7
automatically...
we'll count that as a...
Grace wants to go first.
That's yeah, Grace, is, Grace is really eager, so we're going to skip the voting and just say, Grace, go for it.
All right. First of all, apologies for that, because I do know how to count. It's just my brain automatically went, 1 to 10. Either way, though, I'm always happy to talk about the Mortis arc, because it's just so weird. That's really... why I like it. So I watched Clone Wars for the first time in January, February 2020. And there was a lot of stuff going on at work at that point, and I decided that I needed something to kind of be mindless to watch when I was home. So I started Clone Wars thinking, hey, this animated Star Wars kids show won't be too intense. I was very wrong, but the Mortis arc was really, I think, the first time that I realized how weird this show could get, just absolutely trippy. So just a brief recap, Anakin, Obi-Wan, and Ahsoka end up trapped on this sort of planet where there are three elemental figures, the father, who is kind of the balance of the light side and the dark side, the daughter, who represents the light side, and the son, who represents the dark side. And first of all, the animation in this arc is just really cool. The planet is really interesting. The way that these elementals are presented are as manifestations of the Force are really interesting. And this arc is also, I think, super cool because it really foreshadows Anakin turning to the dark side. In fact, spoiler alert, there's a point where the sun gives Anakin a vision of how he will turn to the dark side and become Darth Vader. So, because Anakin, God bless him, is such an idiot, he's like, I'll just join the dark side now so I don't join the dark side later, because he's a dummy. We love him.
That's like big, like, tapping your temple, like, energy right there. Like,
it really
I feel like
is.
He is living that meme.
He really is. So then, of course, by the end, he has to forget that he saw that vision. The father makes him forget. But I just think it's cool because of the mythology that it introduces with the Force, because it got Liam Neeson to come back as the voice of Qui-Gon, who appears before Obi-Wan in a Force vision. It shows both the extent of Anakin's power, that he's able to control and manipulate both the light side and the dark side, and foreshadows his downfall. And finally, this is very minor, but this is also the first episode in which the outfits change. So in the first two and a half,
that is not minor, Grace.
Yeah, it's very big, because in the first 2.5 seasons, Obi-Wan Anakin's outfits constantly are super cool. They're these cool Jedi armors. But Ahsoka's in this friggin' tube top, which is extremely
She needed mobility in battle.
Yeah, okay. So she's just in this extremely impractical bandeau belly shirt.
I would just be so cold all the time.
Right? Especially because, okay, again, a little geeky, she's a Togruta, so she comes from a warm planet and is used to a warm atmosphere. So
oh my god, Grace looked up the weather on Togruta. I am loving it.
So anyway, all of that aside, this is the first episode in which Ahsoka wears a practical outfit, and it's a kind of cool, sleek number, which is still practical and good for fighting and looks great and is not, you know, weird tube top. So that is my final case for why this is a very good arc.
I did always love how, like, she's the youngest and least experienced part of the group, but she's also the one who is the least protected from just random blaster fire and explosions and debris. Like, clearly, you know, you expect Anakin and Obi-Wan to be well-armored, but also to be, like, well-trained. And here comes Ahsoka, who is just thrown into the absolute deep end and, like, literally, again, is basically wearing a tube top the entire time.
And also in the beginning of the series, she's literally 14 years old. First of all, pretty messed up that they're letting 14-year-old children fight a war, but that's a different conversation. But second of all, now that you have this 14-year-old child fight a war, you're going to let her go out in that outfit? I mean, just ridiculous.
Yeah, it was not necessarily, again, an example of Anakin maybe not being the best master.
Yeah, maybe he just respected her right to choose whatever outfit she wanted to wear.
Yeah, he's like, I'm a cool master. You wear whatever you want.
You can wear that little bikini stupid outfit you want to wear, whatever.
And Obi-Wan's just there like, Anakin. Not the choice I would have made, Anakin.
Give her a coat.
At least put on a coat, Ahsoka.
You'll catch your death, Ahsoka.
Well, I mean, first of all, this is a great arc. I love this arc. I think it was an early example, which is weird to say because it's not necessarily, I guess it's roughly halfway through the show, but it was an early example of Dave Filoni just being totally unconstrained by any boundaries whatsoever. Like, yeah, okay, sure, I will show Anakin his, like, future mass genocidal actions, and then, you know what, I'm just going to have him erase his memory.
Yeah.
Like, teasing us because we know what's going to happen, giving us, like, a split second of Anakin knowing what's going to happen, but then being completely unencumbered and just saying, you know what? No consequences. He doesn't even remember anymore.
That's actually one of my favorite parts of the arc, is that it has absolutely no consequences. It is never mentioned, like, ever again. I think maybe once. There is actually a really cool reference to the Mortis arc in Rebels. You should also watch Star Wars Rebels if you've not. But there is, at one point, a decoration on the side of the Jedi temple that shows the father, son, and daughter, which is a cool callback. That's, like, such a good callback. Love that continuity.
I do want to mention on that, too. I didn't realize until Rebels, when I watched that a couple months ago, and also The Mandalorian this season, I didn't realize Ahsoka, like, after this whole encounter is, like, people think that she turns into, like, the embodiment of the light side. Because, I don't know if you've seen the episodes, but the listeners, I mean. The daughter dies in the, in this arc, and somehow, like, her spirit goes into Ahsoka or something. Like, do y'all know the little, owl that's always hanging around Ahsoka now?
Yeah, of course.
Does someone want to explain that to me? Because I was reading on the internet, and I was confused.
So that little owl thing, I forgot what's called. I think it's called a Morai, I think. That's yes. Either the owl's name or that's what it's called. Someone can correct me. And so that is her symbol, representing her in the Force. And also Haley, as you said, kind of representing the light side of the Force, and who she represents within it. And that was actually something that I was going to point out too about this arc, slightly tangentially, that it's a really good showcase for Anakin and for Ahsoka, because in this 3-episode arc, in each episode you get to see a use of Anakin's powers. So in the first episode, he's able to tame both the light side and the dark side. In the second episode, he's able to channel the light side to revive Ahsoka. And Ahsoka also gets a really cool scene where she's been consumed by the dark side. But she dies, and then the daughter also ends up dying. And as she dies, the last thing she does is allow Anakin to channel the light side into Ahsoka. Where, as Haley was saying, Ahsoka kind of becomes a manifestation of the light side thereafter. And then in the 3rd episode, you have Anakin channeling the dark side and turning to the dark side. So I really like how it shows how there was so much potential for him and for what he could be, how he could have either gone to the light or the dark, and it just ended up on the dark side.
One of the great things about this episode is that it starts a conversation in fandom about how literal should the Force be, or how literal should depictions of the Force be. I mean, this was obviously a controversial arc because it made manifest these parts of the story that we are used to thinking of as, you know, ethereal and almost metaphorical in a sense. I mean, when people say, like, well, the light side of the Force is guiding me, I mean, really what they're saying is that there is some energy out there that is sort of, in a way that we can't understand, pushing them to do something. Well, here you have actual manifestations in the form of people. We would not necessarily call them regular people, but they're certainly people of a sort, and they can, you know, verbally convey what they want to our heroes. And I just remember at the time that was not universally beloved, the idea of having the Force show up to the main characters in this way.
You know, to me, I think part of why I like it is because it's kind of biblical in that sense, where these are very allegorical figures. I don't take them as these three figures are the only true figures of the Force. It's more like an allegory, a sort of a story of showing what each side of the Force does separately and together in a way that is understandable for our protagonists and for the viewers. So I kind of like that symbolism and that almost biblical aspect to it.
Yeah, and I think that's something that Dave Filoni just does really well, like the religious aspect of the Force.
Yeah.
Also in Rebels, he explores that a lot, and I think it's great.
Yeah, you know, the more you put it that way, Grace, the more I like it as a description of really what we're seeing here, especially when you consider the fact that at the end of it, they have no memory of this. There's no proof that they were ever there. This planet is not like any planet we've ever seen before. So it's all wrapped up in this idea that, you know, were they ever actually physically somewhere else, or was this all in their mind? You know, did the cosmic force present all of this as, you know, so that their feeble, you know, mortal brains could understand all of it?
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a really good way of putting it. So I guess kind of to sum up what I think this arc does so well and is kind of a paradigm of what the Clone Wars can do is making the Star Wars mythology very tangible and taking it in directions that we haven't necessarily seen before, and bringing sort of a creativity and a new way of thinking to these ideas that are by now so baked in.
Yeah, and it also, it does something interesting that we don't often see in Star Wars, which is, you know, it's a space fantasy, but there's also a lot of sci-fi in it, and we don't always see this explicit reference to the fact that maybe there are things we don't understand. I mean, maybe there are things in this universe, in this fictional universe, that these characters, that is beyond the sort of the understanding of these characters, as sophisticated as they are. Maybe there are things that even Yoda just can't, you know, grapple with. And obviously there's a later story arc where he is obviously taught things about the Force. But I love that about this arc, and it's actually one of the reasons why I really like Battlestar Galactica, which yes. has a lot of hard sci-fi, but is also very much rooted in this idea that these people are very advanced, like the characters in Star Wars, but there is just something out there that is beyond all of them, that is sort of on another dimension. And I really like how Mortis starts to give us some of that in Star Wars.
I think that is an excellent way to conclude my argument. I'm going to let Eric have concluded my argument for me because he did such a good job of it. So, yes, there it is.
I just had to get the Battlestar Galactica reference in there. I'm sorry. I had to do it. So, Grace, your arc was first. Haley, I think yours comes next. So do you just want to go second?
Sure. Yeah, so mine was I think it's four episodes in season six when Clone Trooper, Arc Trooper Fives discovers, you know, this plot in which the clones have been equipped with inhibitor chips to force them to go along with Order 66 and, you know, kill all of the Jedi later on. There are many parts of this that I just really enjoyed. Mostly just like following Fives' journey sort of symbolizes what a lot of the clones went through during all of this. My favorite is this, I think the second episode in this arc in which, you know, they find the inhibitor chip. They don't really know what it's from. And the entire time he has to go around authority and directly disobey orders. Because first of all, like, the Jedi Council is incompetent. Secondly, you have the Kaminoans who think that they're working for Jedi Master Sifo-Dyas and following his orders, but it's really, you know, Count Dooku. So they're trying to hide reality, which they think it's just sort of like a contingency plan. Like, they don't think the inhibitor chips are going to be used to massacre all of the Jedi. They've been told, you know, it's just if there's like a rogue Jedi who's like against the Republic or something. So you sort of see behind the scenes, they're trying to cover this up, and they keep trying to kill this clone who, I guess I should have mentioned this earlier, this clone, I think his name was Tup. His Order 66 directive sort of fired early, so he killed a Jedi in battle. That's why they ended up going to the Kamino to see what the deal was, and Fives followed him there. Anyway, the entire time, Fives is just trying to figure out what the deal is. He's trying to protect his comrade. He is fighting against, you know, authority because they keep trying to stop him every step of the way. And one thing I loved about it, there's this medical droid in it who is just yes. adorable. And Fives is sort of able to, like, liberate him from having to follow orders. And it's just, like, a fun thing to watch because, you know, the clones are made to follow orders. And so are these droids. And, you know, they wouldn't have found out, you know, the facts or the, or, you know, anything about this if
Fives hadn't been willing to sort of, you know, step outside of that. I just really enjoyed it. There are other things I enjoyed, but if I would be interested to hear y'all's thoughts too.
Yeah, I mean, I love this arc. And Haley, I think you captured a lot of what makes it so good. I think Clone Wars is in part excellent because it's so grand of a scale. I mean, it's about a galactic war, but there are stories that manage to be so personal. And this story really focuses on Fives and his own personal journey. So it's almost intimate in a way how you follow him on this journey of discovery, and also tragic because you know that even if he discovers the truth, which he does, it's going to end poorly anyway.
Yeah, it's such a great display of the value of a show like this. I mean, I remember when Clone Wars premiered, a lot of people were wondering what the point was of a TV show that was set before a movie we'd already seen. This is, to me, a great example of what it can do. Again, we know where this is going to end. We know that, you know, they are not going to stop the bad guy. And so it's all really about this person who we've known for multiple seasons going on this journey of realizing that literally his whole life has been a lie. I mean, a lot of people, you know, they say that and there's a certain element of hyperbole to it. In this case, it's quite literally true. He was designed, you know, built and quickly raised to fight a war that he was never going to be able to win. And there, you know, again, I have to give so much credit to Dee Bradley Baker, the voice actor behind not only Fives, but also Tup and all the other clones, really driving home the tragedy here. I think that is the best word, tragedy, for this story arc, because it's hard to watch, honestly, when you know where things are going, because you keep wanting them to just get a little bit ahead of the bad guys, to just move a little bit faster, as if that can sort of short circuit what we know is going to happen. But obviously, there's nothing to be done about it. And so it's really just this person who is trapped, realizing, you know, as the trap closes in around him, that there's nowhere for him to go.
It's so frustrating. mainly because, like, the Jedi are, like, they start off in the right place trying to get the facts on this. And then you, like, sort of see the bureaucracy of it, and, like, Palpatine is behind the scenes, like, oh, send the chip to this different, like, the Republic facility instead of the Jedi Council. And, like, it just, like, they get so close to figuring it out. And you sort of have to wonder, like, what would have happened if they had figured it out. I honestly, like, feel like he could have spun it, you know? Like, oh, this was a separatist plot. And, like, he could have gotten away with it anyway. But what I really liked about it, at least in the episode that I was able to rewatch today, which was the second one in the arc, is just how it really explores what it means to be a clone, and, like, you know, Fives discovering all of this was a lie and all of that. But also, like, they're trying to kill Tup. The Kaminoans, they have orders to kill Tup to stop the Jedi from finding this inhibitor chip. And, you know, Fives is trying to stop this from happening. There's, at one point, he says, you know, we weren't created to be disposed of this way. Like, and the little medical droid I mentioned, he said, perhaps you were. Like, maybe this is how you were viewed by the people who made you. And it just sort of, like, is devastating, you know? Yeah. Like, as a kid watching this, like, you're like, wow, war is hell. And, like, what is the value of human life? And it just makes you ask a lot of, like, you know, big questions.
I love
the droid, by the way, voiced by the same actor who voices the main droid in the D Squad story arc. I know that if you're a Clone Wars fan, you surely love the D Squad story arc. One of the least controversial story arcs. Nobody complained about that. Definitely not me in my written reviews multiple years ago.
To be honest, I could not make it through. I watched, like, the first episode, and we decided to skip the rest of the arc.
Well, okay, so, Haley, let me ask you this. I also love the way that the Jedi go through this arc, especially when you see Shaak-Ti at first really being on Fives' side as much as she can.
She's,
you know,
so dropped the ball.
Like, but then, as you said, she drops the ball. So then here's my question for you. How much of it is she didn't go as far as she could have, and how much of it is her hands are tied to a certain degree?
Well, I don't know. I just, if you have a clone trooper killing Jedi, you would think that they would take this a lot more seriously than they did. And what I like about it is it teaches, you know, viewers like a very healthy skepticism of authority. Like Shaak-Ti, there's this one scene where she's talking to Palpatine and she's got whoever the Kaminoan lady, I can't remember her name, next to her. And that's when Palpatine is saying, oh, just send it to our medical facility instead of the, you know, the Jedi Council. We'll do a better job. And Shaak-Ti sort of like protests a little bit. And then she's like, OK, like, fine, we're agreed. And like the entire time she could have done more to like actually get to the truth. But instead, she sort of just accepted, like, she trusted Palpatine. She trusted the Kaminoans when she shouldn't have. And then it just sort of like tells the story of the entire way that Jedi, oh, here's an army that just appeared out of thin air. Let's just use it. Like, that works.
Yeah.
Like, the lack of critical thinking is just astounding.
I really want to pick up on that excellent point that Haley makes, because I think that a lot of what's so interesting about this arc is seeing how not only how the Kaminoans and how the Republic see clones, but how the Jedi see clones as well. Because you're right. I mean, this convenient army was just dropped into their lap. And these are human beings. They are sentient human beings. And the Jedi are like, yeah, totally cool. We'll just use them as our cannon fodder for this war. There are no moral qualms we have with that. And then so then Clone Wars, you really get the chance to see that the clones are distinguishable and they have distinct personalities. And you see that in their very names, how they have nicknames for each other. They aren't just clones. They think of each other as brothers. And even though the Jedi have respect for the clones and appreciate them, and there are some really great Jedi clone relationships like Anakin and Rex and Ahsoka and Rex and Plo Koon and Wolf and Obi-Wan and Cody, but ultimately when push comes to shove and a clone is saying something, they're not going to believe the clone. Like, Fives comes up with this, he has the evidence, and ultimately Shaak-Ti is like, well, you know, that's nice that you have the evidence, but my hands are tied.
It's so frustrating.
Like, if they, it shows how they don't necessarily see the clones as full people, even though they pretend that they do.
Yeah. Well, and Shaak-Ti is interesting because, you know, she obviously spends, I guess we're given to understand that she spends most of the war at the Kamino cloning facilities. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of, it raises an interesting question of, like, has she been captured to a certain degree? You know, there's this idea in the government of, like, regulatory capture where, you know, the regulators start to embrace the worldview of the companies that they're supposed to regulate. And you can almost imagine Shaak-Ti starting to see the clones in a way that perhaps most of the other Jedi don't, because she is there for the mechanical part of their existence, where they're being programmed, where it's not about them being in battle and organically learning lessons and being people. It's about them being batches of DNA that are slowly converted into soldiers. She is there from A to Z to see that whole process. And so I could easily imagine her having a particularly, you know, warped perspective of what a clone is and what a clone can be. I mean, if all you think about is the way that the clones are basically biological computers, then when a clone comes to you with an idea that's pretty outlandish, my first thought would probably also be that they're malfunctioning in some way. Yeah, not to defend it, just to be clear. I'm not saying that Shaak-Ti is the good guy here, but
that's a good point. I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, Shaak-Ti would maybe think of them differently, because those clone Jedi relationships I mentioned before, those are clones and Jedi who have been out in the field together. And there's one point in season 7, the newest season, where Anakin goes out on a limb for Rex, who has kind of a crazy theory. And he's reminded by Padme, his wife, in a conversation that Rex has always been there for you, so the least you can do is be there for Rex. So on the ground, they have that close relationship. It's a good point, I think, to recognize that maybe if you did just see the clones as biological computers, you wouldn't necessarily feel the need to advocate for them in the same way.
Yeah.
So speaking of aggravating decisions by Jedi who should know better, my story arc is the last story arc of season 5. It begins with ends with The Wrong Jedi, which is the season finale, and is the story of Ahsoka Tano being framed for a bombing at the Jedi Temple. She is eventually put on trial, but before that, she starts to get a sense of actually what's going on here. The actual assassin goes after her. She ends up teaming up with Asajj Ventress. The assassin goes after Asajj Ventress. There's a lot of backstabbing and fights that just didn't have to happen. And throughout it all, of course, Anakin is, you know, clearly racked by guilt at not being able to do more for Ahsoka. And there are some great scenes between the two of them, where you can really see that this is tough on Anakin, because he has been, you know, raised to see the Jedi as the authority on pretty much everything, and his Padawan, someone to whom he's become incredibly close, is pointing out the sort of the problems with that view, because they're not perfect. They can be tricked just as much as anybody. And of course that brings Ahsoka and Anakin into this storm of the Jedi and the Republic and the relationship between the two organizations, which, you know, a big part of the reason I chose this arc is because we don't see a lot of that. This is the arc that I think shows the most dimensions of what would it actually mean if the Jedi existed in a galactic government. I mean, the very nature of the Jedi Order raises so many questions about how would they work with the government? What would the jurisdictional lines be? You know, there's I think it's Tarkin, who, by the way, plays a great role in this arc as almost setting up the sort of the cold-hearted, you know, bureaucracy that Anakin later becomes very comfortable with as Darth Vader. But he says, you know, Republic personnel were killed in this explosion too, and so, you know, we're going to take over the investigation, and Ahsoka will be tried in a military court. And, you know, there's so much to love there, including the sort of the legitimacy of military courts. But it's this great moment where you remember, oh yeah, like the lines are blurry here. Like the Jedi and the Republic, you would imagine that there have been previous occasions where they fight over who gets to be in charge of a particular activity. You know, we're used to seeing the Jedi as generals on the front lines. And so it's normal for us to sort of treat them as being in charge. But back on Coruscant, it's not that simple, especially when there's a political aspect to it. And we see Chancellor Palpatine, obviously, you know, telling everybody during the trial this beautiful speech, one of the best scenes really in the whole series, where he is trying to reassure people and sound like a mild-mannered voice of reason, but he is subtly, and I recommend everybody go back and watch the scene, he is subtly impugning the trust of the Jedi and causing people to start to doubt whether they are in fact as great and as mythic as the Republic has presented them as in the past. So there's this whole Jedi Republic interaction and conflict and tension that I love and that I wish we'd seen more of. And then of course the other big part of this is Ahsoka. We've really watched her grow over these 5 seasons, and now we get to see her at her lowest point, at her most relatable, when she has essentially been, you know, all ties severed with this organization that, you know, as much as Anakin grew up with the Jedi, she was basically raised from birth by the Jedi. And, you know, you can see, especially in the earlier seasons, how much trust she has in the Jedi Order. And at this point, at the end of season 5, it's a wake-up call for her. I mean, she sees that there's a lot that they get wrong, and it starts to teach her, you know, you can't rely on anybody but yourself. And this beautiful, beautiful series of episodes. Ashley Eckstein does a fantastic job bringing Ahsoka to life in a way that, you know, I've never related as much to her as I did in that story arc, just as a person who doesn't know who to trust, who is trying to constantly pick themselves up from being knocked over by these people that they thought they could count on. And there's just so much. I mean, I could go on for hours, but I would like to hear opinions from other people as well. But, you know, the Barriss Offee stuff and her disillusionment and the gut punch to Ahsoka of having her friend betray her like this, the Order 66 vibes of, you know, when the clones are chasing Ahsoka and they're shooting at her and they surround her, and then there's like the gunship puts the spotlight on her and it gets you as close as you can get to Order 66 until the actual story plays out again for Ahsoka in season 7. There's so much to love in here. I hope I've given you guys something to pick from. But what do you guys think about this episode, the story arc?
I love this story arc. I think you did such a good job of recapping it and why it's so brilliant on so many levels. And I think really, too, it's extremely effective in undermining faith in the Jedi. And it's not just Ahsoka and Anakin who are being disillusioned, but to an extent, the audience as well. And then it also you also see how you get to a point where you're at Revenge of the Sith. It's clear that the Jedi are failing. And as you mentioned, that's not entirely their fault. There's this weird tension with the Republic and knowing that they've been manipulated by Palpatine all along. But you also really get an idea of how Anakin could become so disillusioned with the Jedi in seeing how they treat his Padawan and how she isn't given the benefit of the doubt. And his own issues, I think you begin to see how he gets to the place that he's at the beginning of Revenge of the Sith. And especially because in the last episode of the Wrong Jedi arc, when Ahsoka leaves the Order, she's given the opportunity to come back. Anakin holds out her Padawan beads. She closes his hand and rejects his offering. She goes out of the temple. He runs after her, and he says, "I know what it's like to want to leave the Order. There are times when I've really wanted to leave the Order." And Ahsoka goes, "I know." And he is really shocked by that. But I think it's a wake-up call for him in a way that he hasn't really had to grapple with his own struggles with the Jedi Order in such a visceral way before this arc. And it really sets up his state of mind for Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know, I like the sort of thinking about, like, what if he had, like, thought about this more and, you know, had decided to leave the Jedi Order, and then he could just have a happy family with young Luke and Leia, and they would all be happily ever after. But when I watched this arc, I was just, like, so annoyed by it because it happened so fast. And, like, there was no warning beforehand. And Barriss, her whole reasoning was, like, oh, the Jedi only believe in violence. And then she was like, okay, so now I'm just going to, like, bomb some people? Like, how does that solve your problem? I like all of the things that y'all like about this. I hated, like, the injustice of it, and it just made me angry to watch.
Yeah, Barriss is... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say real quick, I think that's fair, and I do think that the weakest link in an otherwise strong series of episodes is pinning it on Barriss, because it really does seem like it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough because clearly they wanted... You know, they needed that gut punch of somebody that she trusted betraying her. And she doesn't exactly have... We don't know of too many of her friends. And obviously it can't be Obi-Wan or Anakin. So, you know, they needed it to be somebody who for whom this would be really tough for her. You know, I will say, I think... And this is sort of a cop-out. And I might end up, you know, disagreeing with this excuse in the future. But in this case... I think there's an element of when you are a Force user and you spend your whole life immersed in this kind of the sea of, like, feelings, for lack of a better word, and, like, vibes. Like, when Sidious starts to do his plan and the Force starts to, you know, wither a little bit, and you see the Jedi acting in morally compromising ways, and, you know, whether they should be fighting at all is a separate question. I'm sure we could do a whole episode about. I don't think it's morally indefensible to fight a war of self-defense, but... You know, I can imagine for her, you know, much like the dark side kind of warps Sidious over time, I could imagine it being very corrupting on her own brain, just her, the way that she thinks and just her ability to be rational and reasonable. And I could totally see somebody just falling into a corrupt, you know, despairing sort of trap, partly of her own making, but partly of just the way that the Force is and how it's out of whack at this point. And she just, she's enraged that the Jedi aren't living up to their ideals, and she's perhaps not just not thinking clearly because she's already somewhat corrupted by the, you know, she's giving voice to her anger, and it's almost like once you let yourself be angry to a certain degree, it's like, you know, lighting a match in a room, you know, that is already full of a lot of flammable things, and that sort of starts her down this roller coaster of losing control of her own, you know, her own reason.
I would, I'm going to push back against yes, that a please. Little bit. I think that's a very generous way of looking at it. And I think that Barriss being corrupted by the dark side and recognizing the faults of the Jedi, I think that's very possible, and I can see how that would happen for her. Particularly since her master is Master Luminara, who is one of the Jedi who's known for being kind of more chill and more like the job of Jedi is to be protectors, and then for Barriss to see that the Jedi have become just warriors. I can see that. I get that. What strikes me as kind of false in this plot line is how she betrays Ahsoka. Like, I can see her blowing up the Jedi Temple, a bit extreme, but sure, I'll make that leap. But betraying Ahsoka, I think, is what makes me push back against your argument there, because Ahsoka and she really are good friends. And it really does come as a shock that Barriss would so willingly throw her under the bus.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, it is tough to see how she could, you know, she's got to pin it on somebody and she chooses Ahsoka, and that just raises questions about, well, does she think that Ahsoka is part of the problem?
Right. Yeah, because it, I mean, to me it seems pretty clear that Ahsoka, who is the same age as Barriss, is not part of the problem. But, you know, I understand that narratively they had to do this. They had to make it shocking, because if it was just some random Jedi that we didn't have an attachment to, we would be like, yeah, okay, who cares? So making the villain Barriss makes it shocking, but I still don't necessarily think that it was the best narrative choice.
So before we wrap up, let me just ask briefly, because she's a great sort of, you know, minor character who becomes more important across the Clone Wars story. Thoughts on Asajj Ventress in this arc? I, for one, really loved how she was able to relate to Ahsoka in the sense that they'd both been, you know, cast aside by the people that they trusted. And, you know, there's no way to, you know, fully redeem Asajj Ventress for everything that she's done. She's done a lot of bad things. But I did like how Ahsoka had to go to somebody, you know, it showed her desperation that she had to go to somebody she never would have trusted otherwise.
Yeah, that's one thing I really liked about it. I think Ventress is very cool. And, like, some of the arcs that I also enjoyed that we didn't get to mention here were, like, when she's on her home world and just, like, dealing with some stuff there. I think her backstory is very cool. And, you know, I enjoyed seeing, you know, sort of more of a gray area there where she's working with Ahsoka and, you know, not trying to kill her.
Yeah, I would agree. I love Ventress as a character. And earlier in this discussion that we're currently having, Eric, when you talked about there being kind of unexplainable things in the Force, I think Ventress's backstory with the Witches of Dathomir and their magic is really a great example of the unexplainable thing.
Can I just say?
They're so creepy. I love it. I love.
I also like those episodes. I can't believe I watched that as a child, which I'm giving away my age here, but I was a child when those were coming out and we watched them. And like, so much of that is just like sketchy. Like, I don't know if I would let, you know, children younger than like 8 watch that, but I mean, it was fun as a kid watching it.
But seeing, I would agree with that, but seeing Ventress kind of after this journey we've watched her go through where she was rejected by Dooku, she went back to her family all died, she feels very alone and abandoned and betrayed.
Oh, and also, wasn't she previously a Jedi youngling?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So you sort of have both sides of the disillusioned former Jedi here, where, like, she went to the dark side, you know, Barriss and this is, like, bombing people, and then you have Ahsoka, who eventually leaves the Jedi Order. You know, it's just a lot of broken people left in their wake.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent point, and part of what makes Ventress and Ahsoka's relationship so good in this arc is that at this point they both feel like they've been abandoned by their masters, and because of that mutual feeling, they are able to bridge their differences and work together.
Well, I think the lesson here is that The Clone Wars is one of the best shows that has ever been on television. Every story arc could fuel a 45-minute conversation on its own, and I have no doubt that we will be revisiting some of the story arcs that we referenced here, and also some of the story arcs we didn't even get into in future episodes. I think that's a safe bet.
For sure. I mean, we didn't even get to our favorite ridiculous arcs.
Oh, that's
Zero
right. D-Squad, I mean, just the fact that there's this little dude who just, like, sits inside a droid's head and just is a drill sergeant yelling at droids. I love it. You just have to love it.
Do you, though?
All right, I will save it for another conversation, but I was very down on that arc, and then I rewatched it as part of my full rewatch, and I am much more up on it now.
You knew what to expect. Say, you knew what you were getting into.
Yeah.
True.
I will say I couldn't make it through the first time I watched Clone Wars. I couldn't make it through that arc. I watched the first two episodes and then was like, nah. But then I rewatched the whole thing a couple of months ago.
So how does it
boyfriend.
End?
Well, no. Don't tell her, because I think I just came up with an idea for a bonus episode, which is the three of us.
No, I don't
get on
watch
the line
it.
And we just listen to Haley watch the entire arc and just listen to her commentary.
It's just painful.
Do it for the
not
show.
Not to be rude to droids, like, but it was just painful for me.
Hostage situation.
My favorite. Haley. We all need to rewatch is the Zero the Hutt arc, where you have Cad Bane and, like, his and Zero the Hutt's, like, weird girlfriend who gets out of jail and then later kills him in cold blood. Like, it's awesome.
And the voice, I mean, the voice on Size Noodles is
that?
Just, like, absolute bonkers.
Decision. It just seems rude to, like, people from New Orleans.
Yeah, so nasal and so southern.
His mom is also really weird. Doesn't he go to see his mom? Yeah,
yes, and her name is Mama the Hutt. True.
Wow.
That's absolutely true. 100% true.
But the good thing about that, yes. Like, I, as a child, thought that Cad Bane was the coolest thing in the world, and he is very cool in those episodes.
He is. He's very cool in almost every episode that he's in.
Yeah.
Yeah, we should do an episode sometime on great secondary characters in Clone Wars.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts about this episode or suggest topics for future shows, you just drop us a line at hothtakes@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @hothtakes. I'm on Twitter @Grace_Segers, Segers, and Eric is at Eric Geller. That's Geller with two E's, because sometimes there are people with Geller where the second vowel is an A, but not this Eric. This Eric is two E'd Eric Geller. And Haley is at Byrdinator, BYRDINATOR. Haley made our incredible logo and banner art, and Eric edited the show and put together our music. Although for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. If you want to find our complete archive, you can check out our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. Just tell them to subscribe on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. We'll see you next time. May the Force be with you.